From the heart of our nation's capital, this is Washington Watch Weekend Edition. Now, here's your host, David Salkeld.
This week on the Weekend Edition of Washington Watch, the House is once again without a leader, Biden's no new taxes moment, and answers to the new trans movement. Greetings, fellow patriots. I am David Salkeld, and I'm a constitutional conservative, Christian husband, and Reagan Republican. After months of inaction and only recent movement on things that should have been started long ago, the House passed a motion this week to vacate the chair, which means Kevin McCarthy is no longer the Speaker of the House. Joining Tony Perkins on Thursday to discuss the path forward was Dr. Andy Harris, who represents the 1st Congressional District of Maryland. Here's Tony Perkins.
Dr. Harris, welcome back to Washington Watch. Always great to see you.
Good to be with you, Tony.
Well, I've had conversations with a number of your colleagues as they are huddling, trying to discuss next steps. What's the latest that you can tell us?
Well, look, I think we're going to resolve this next week. We have a deep bench. That's what we found out because when former Speaker McCarthy said he's not going to run for it again, several very good individuals stepped forward, Jim Jordan, Steve Scalise. Tom Emmer is probably in the mix, other folks as well. And I think we're going to come to a decision next week, and then we're going to move forward.
In the meantime, can the Appropriations Committee do any additional work, or are we at a standstill?
Well, the committee itself could do work, but it's unclear whether we could bring a product to the floor. That's really where we stopped. We had passed a rule to bring two of the bills to the floor this week. Then that's when we moved and successfully vacated the speakership. But it's unclear whether the Speaker pro tem, who is Patrick McHenry from North Carolina, whether he has the ability to allow any floor action other than the election of the Speaker at this point. So I think we're in a standstill until after the Columbus Day holiday. We're going to come back. Hopefully on Wednesday, we elect a new Speaker and we go right into taking up those appropriations bills and get the last seven done in the House.
How much time is going to be required to get those remaining seven funding bills through the process? Because this was a big sticking point. I mean, this is the omnibus, the minibuses that we've seen before where all these have been lumped together. That was the big issue and the concern among yourself and other conservatives. So is there going to be time, and how much time will it take to get that done?
Well, we had it mapped out again before the motion to vacate. We had it mapped out so that by November 1st, we would have had all the bills on the floor, not necessarily have passed all the bills. Some will not pass. That's OK. The legislative process is we should discuss them on the floor. This will set us back a week and a half, 2 weeks. So we still could have them all done by the time the continuing resolution is up on November 17th, we'd probably have to cancel a week of recess in November. I think we should at that point, if that's what we need to do. Tony, we could have it done by the end of the continuing resolution. Hopefully the Senate also takes some of these up on the floor. Senate hasn't taken a single one up on the floor yet. Hopefully they begin their floor action as well.
Well, Senator Rick Scott of Florida is leading an effort over in the Senate to block bills not related to government funding, because you see almost every day when the Senate is in session, Chuck Schumer kind of taunting the Republicans in the House about government funding. But they've done nothing over there in terms of advancing their appropriations bills.
That's absolutely right. Four bills on the floor. Those four bills account for about 70% of our discretionary spending. Senate has taken up no bills on the floor. So we're actually way ahead of the Senate. Again, if the Senate would move on a defense appropriation bill, I think we could go to conference pretty quickly and at least take care of our troops so that they're not involved in a continuing resolution if we should need one in the middle of November.
So, Congressman Harris, your colleagues kind of understand that the Democrats are just kind of standing there, I think, salivating, hoping the Republicans can't come together so that they can just continue to proliferate government spending. Because if the Republicans can't get leadership together to move forward with these appropriations bills, we're going to see another continuation, probably a year-long funding of government.
Well, if we do go to a year-long funding of government, because of the debt ceiling deal, it will be at 1% less spending than this year. So, government spending will get a haircut, not a big one, But considering that inflation is present, it's a significant spending decrease, 1%. I think we should decrease our spending more than that. We should return to pre-COVID spending levels. But again, worst comes to worst, we will, by law, be spending less this coming fiscal year this fiscal year we're in right now than the last fiscal year.
Well, I'm with you. I hope that the Republicans can come together next week and select a leader to move forward and get these appropriations bills forward, because I think the Republicans are on the right track. I understand narrow margins and trying to lead the Republicans through makes it very difficult for leadership, but we're moving in the right direction, so we just need to continue to pray that that occurs. I want to get your response, Congressman Harris, to President Biden yesterday, once again, even though he's been slapped down by the court before, is saying he's going to find another way to eliminate student loan debt with taxpayer dollars.
Look, I just don't get it. I guess I understand the politics of it, Tony. But look, I have small business people in my district. You know, they run a plumbing company. They run an HVAC company. They have a truck loan. You know, they have to borrow money to buy a truck. Why aren't we forgiving those loans? I mean, the bottom line is, you know, a student loan was taken out by someone who signed their name and said they were going to pay it back. There are mortgage loans, there are credit card loans, there are other loans where people do the same thing. Why are we picking student loans to be the one that's forgiven with taxpayer dollars? And that's significant because we just ended a fiscal year with $2.2 trillion deficit, $2.2 trillion. And we're going to give away money to people who have signed something that said they're going to pay their loan back. And we expect, you know, 90% of taxpayers to pay for those 10% who are not going to pay their student loans back. It's just basically unfair.
I want to get you to respond to something the president said along those lines yesterday, where he actually compared the student loan to the PPP plan during the COVID. I want to play clip number 4 and get you to respond to this.
Let's be clear. Some of the same elected Republicans or members of Congress who were strongly opposed to giving relief to students got hundreds of thousands of dollars in relief for themselves to keep their businesses open. Several members of Congress got over $1 million, and all those loans were forgiven. The hypocrisy of this I find stunning.
Congressman, how do you respond to that?
Look, it's apples and oranges. The bottom line is that, the federal government forced businesses to close. Again, students were at school. They took out these loans. These loans had nothing to do with COVID. The president is making up excuses for a purely political purpose. Look, he reads the polls. He's down in the polls. He's desperate. He has to get people to vote for him. And he's attempting to buy votes with taxpayer dollars.
But I want to go a little further, because if I recall correctly, and you're closer to the process, but when the pay protection plan came out, there was it was communicated that you wouldn't pay back these loans. This was more than a loan as long as you kept the employees in place. This was about taking care of the employees who were going to be paid during these business shutdowns. So it is apples and oranges. It is a big difference between the two.
Absolutely, Tony. There's no question about it. This president wants to forgive student loans that are 10 years old, that predated COVID by 7 or 8 years. It has nothing to do with COVID. It's mixing apples and oranges. This is purely for political purposes. Look, I get it. He wants to buy the votes of the people who have student loans. He shouldn't do it with taxpayer dollars. Taxpayers should resent that. Even if you have a loan, you should resent it, because who knows what he's going to spend your money on next week.
Right.
With a $2.2 trillion deficit. $2.2 trillion, Tony, that's completely unprecedented when we're not at war and we're not in a pandemic.
And that's all the while he's running around claiming that he has reduced the deficit, largest deficit reduction in history. Congressman Andy Harris, always great to see you. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Congressman Andy Harris, Dr. Congressman Andy Harris of Maryland. You know, it's also interesting that this is the second time around coming into an election where the president has promised the student loan bailouts. You know, you get two bites of the apple. He's actually buying boats twice with the same lie. Hopefully students, these folks that have college degrees now, will be wiser than that. All right, don't go away. We're coming back with more Washington Watch on the other side of the break.
The persecution of Christians grows globally every year and continues to become more aggressive and dangerous. Family Research Council's Leila Gilbert, Ariel Del Turco, and Lieutenant General Jerry Boykin's book, Heroic Faith, shares the true stories from those who have faced religious persecution and takes a look at the heartbreaking circumstances Christians encounter due to the difficult and sometimes deadly hostility to their faith. Get your copy wherever books are sold or at frc.org/heroicfaith.
This is Washington Watch. I'm Tony Perkins, your host, and once again, the website, tonyperkins.com. All right, according to an announcement released yesterday from Homeland Security Secretary Mayorkas, the United States has an acute and immediate need to build a wall on the southern border. In response to this need, Secretary Mayorkas issued an order waiving some of the left's most cherished environmental protection laws to speed up border wall construction. Now, I welcome this, quite frankly, but this contradicts everything the Biden administration has insisted since they took over. Is the White House responding to the polling, to the political pressure? Is it the criticism from Democratic mayors and governors that led to this U-turn? And with as many as 9 million illegal immigrants who have already entered the country since President Biden took office, is it too little too late? Joining me now to discuss this and more, Congressman Pete Sessions. He serves on the House Committee on Oversight and Accountability and the House Financial Services Committee. He represents the 17th Congressional District of Texas. Congressman Sessions, welcome back to the program. Good to see you.
Tony, thank you very much. What an amazing set of circumstances now that we find the Biden administration and Democrats in. I'm reminded of from going back easily with Bill Clinton, Barack Obama, and now they want to be firefighters, but what they turn out to be is arsonists by the way they start it, and then try and take credit for what they do to be firefighters. They caused the problem. It is a problem. It's a huge problem for not just the state of Texas, but New York, California, and so many places. And now that they've got the mayor of New York City paying $10 million or almost $10 million a day to house these immigrants, putting them up in hotels, which are forcing New Yorkers to not get revenue that might come from people visiting, the tremendous cost. Now, Eric Adams is headed down south of the border to tell people, please do not come. It is a political nightmare for them.
This is good news in terms of that the wall that started during the Trump administration is going to continue on. But what assurances do we have that this is not just something to pacify the current political wave that is moving against them, and it will, in fact, be followed through? I think we're looking at about 24 miles of wall that's with this contract that's being let out. So Are you convinced that this is a true change of heart, or is it just political?
I believe that it comes from an abject failure, and this is in Stark County, which is on our border. Stark County is home to tens of thousands of people who migrate through this every single month. It is placing law enforcement in difficult circumstances. It is placing local people in the cities, Eagle Pass, and other places in a very difficult position, not only from the threat to their families, but national security. So the bottom line is, Tony, they are catching flack for what they've done. And one would have to ask in the first place, what were you trying to accomplish? What was your goal? How are you going to handle all these people? And once again, the Democratic Party and Joe Biden, ready, fire, aim.
Yeah. I was looking at it. It's actually 20 miles that they're going to be building here that they announced. But this comes after, I think they've sold off more than $300 million of materials for the wall for just $2 million. I mean, again, this makes absolutely no sense what this administration is doing.
Well, it goes back to, Tony, to that original plan that was all about politics to match their political ambitions of completely turning this country into a one-party system. But what it's done is destabilize these states and cities that allow illegal immigrants to flourish there. And this is the typical thing that Democrats are good at. They get an inch and they take a mile. This is untenable for America. And these images are harming their opportunity every single time, just like rule of law. They have massive problems as a result of what they instilled and created. And this is placing federal law enforcement in a bad position. But they did this. We did not negotiate this.
Right. And the polling and the trends suggest that the issues you brought up, lawlessness, crime, border, and the economy are going to be major issues in the 2024 election. And frankly, the administration and the Democratic Party have very little to stand on when it comes to those three issues.
Well, the American people have heard the story. They understand it. They are looking for my party. I am a Republican. They're looking for our party, and I am too, to take a strong stand now that we are in budget negotiations for appropriations for 24, to be able to stand on solid ground and say, we are not going to fund the government if they do not fix these problems. So they preempted that. They're starting to do this. It's just in one area, but next to Arizona is probably the biggest gap that we have in the border.
Congressman Pete Sessions, I want to thank you for taking time to join us today. Always great to see you. Thanks so much, and have a great afternoon.
Tony, thank you very much.
You can find out more about Pete Sessions and the ongoing crisis at the border when you visit TonyPerkins.com. That's TonyPerkins.com.
Christians must be aware of the issues that threaten the culture and the church. To this end, Family Research Council's David Clawson, along with co-authors Denny Burke and Colin Smothers, released a new book titled Male and Female He Created Them, a study on gender, sexuality, and marriage. This book was written to help Christians understand what Scripture teaches and how to address them biblically. Included in the study are complimentary videos that expound upon the themes of each chapter. Order your copy of this book at hecreatedthem.org.
Welcome back to the weekend edition of Washington Watch. I'm David Salkill. On Tuesday of this week, Family Research Council President Tony Perkins had the chance to chat with our very own Dr. Jennifer Bowens about the movement to prevent minors from getting gender mutilation surgeries, as well as a new publication from Family Research Council that exposes the myths of the transgender movement. Here's how that interview got started.
Dr. Bowens, welcome back to Washington Watch.
It's good to be back, Tony.
So tell us about this new publication and why it is so necessary at this time.
Yeah, so this resource is intended to be kind of for policymakers, first of all, because a lot of the testimonies that we've given at the state level or even up on the Hill have been the questions have that we've answered have been about these issues. So we put this together because we just kept hearing these questions over and over, and these are the issues that scaffold the trans issue. And the research that's used to come alongside and push these very invasive physiological interventions. So this is a great resource because it includes a lot of citations, a lot of the research that has been used to promote these procedures. So it's all in one place. Pretty much every question that's been asked on this issue is included in this packet here.
So who is this targeted toward in terms of who benefits most from having access to this publication?
So really, we wrote this with the intention that this would be used for policymakers, but it's so user-friendly that it is really for anyone who has questions. Or, you know, maybe you're a parent or a grandparent and you have a child that you care about who's come home from school, and they're giving some of the same lines that we often hear, that, you know, if I don't transition, I'm going to commit suicide. Or, you know, what are some of the root issues that go along with someone who claims to be transgender? So we talk about the social contagion factor. And then we also talk about some of the things that maybe if you've been following this issue, some of the arguments or the logic that hasn't been presented in some of the public forums. For example, I speak a little bit about the DSM, that's the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual for Mental Disorders. And I look at the gender dysphoria diagnosis and compare it to other diagnoses that are listed in the DSM that would be for children, and how we approach a diagnosis for children, and how gender dysphoria is different. And these aren't necessarily hard factual things, but just things to say, you know, hey, there's a little bit of a difference in how we approach gender dysphoria, and why is that the case? So it's a thought-provoking document, as well as providing some real counters to the arguments that have been proposed in the psychological and medical fields.
So let me ask you about that, Dr. Ballins. Give me two ways in which gender dysphoria is treated differently than some other disorder.
Yeah, so there's a class of disorders in the DSM that specifically are given when a person has a long pattern of behavior or thought. And typically when we're working with a child, we don't want to diagnose them until they're 18. And why is that? Well, we know that the child is still developing and they're still changing. And so you want to wait until their brain and their development has reached a certain marker. And so when they've reached that marker, then we kind of go back and say, let's look at this, and maybe they do in fact have this disorder. But what you have with gender dysphoria is somebody receiving a diagnosis within 6 months before they're 18, before they've completed development. And then when you compare these types of diagnoses and the interventions attached to them, what you find is that gender dysphoria has a far more invasive and actually more invasive than any other diagnosis in the DSM. So not only are we diagnosing early with something that would be considered a lifelong enduring pattern, but we're also attaching interventions that are really dangerous and life-altering while a person's still a child.
So when you're talking about these invasive, we're talking about surgeries and irreversible treatments?
Yeah, that's right. We're talking about making alterations to one's physiology that are irreparable, and certainly we don't even know the psychological ramifications of these interventions.
And you,
that hasn't
you,
been studied.
You touched on this, one of the reasons that we wait until a child reaches adulthood into a certain age is because well into adulthood, the brain is continuing to develop. So for a adolescent to be able to make a decision that is going to have effects upon their life for the rest of their life, that's not something that we've historically allowed in this country.
Yeah, that's right. And that's why we don't give diagnoses that are in the DSM that are heavier diagnoses that indicate someone has a lifelong pattern until they're 18. So then it's out of character, so to speak, to give a child such a heavy diagnosis that says this is how you'll always identify.
Is a 2 or 3 year phase, is that a lifelong pattern?
Not when you're a child.
Right.
I mean, think about how many of us, I mean, I myself thought I'd be an astronaut for several years, but I was influenced greatly by Star Wars. Now, I'm not an astronaut.
I thought I'd be a radio talk show host when I was a kid. Look what happened.
Look what happened. So some patterns are enduring, but it's better to wait until a person reaches adulthood to make those lifelong decisions.
So we see the differences there. Now, I'm going to ask you a question. Why? Why? Why do we treat this different than any other condition?
Well, I think there are many factors, but I think for our purposes today, one that's worth noting is the political factor. And even trans advocates, I'll get that out, they actually can get upset with the U.S. and our use of gender dysphoria in the DSM, because a lot of activists believe that this is a civil rights issue, and that it shouldn't be treated as a clinical issue. But they will say, especially those from other countries, will make comments that America has to for insurance purposes. So, you know, what you see in the activist space is a lot of times using the DSM for the purposes, the end goal of transitioning or imposing these medical interventions on children. When it's convenient. And that's not to say that there isn't a real issue that some kids suffer, but to divorce this idea from politics would be equally wrong and not paint a clear picture of what's going on in politics and the DSM.
So in this publication, The Trans Youth Phenomenon, Critiques and Hard Questions, Dr. Ballins, you and your co-authors seek to kind of cut through the political and take us to the fact-based evidence that is behind this issue so that policymakers, parents, and others will know how to deal with it.
That's right. That's the purpose of this document.
All right. And where can folks get a copy besides TonyPerkins.com?
And FRC.org. It's on the main homepage.
All right. Once again, great work, Dr. Ballins. Always great to have you on the program, and glad you're at the Family Research Council.
Me too.
Well, unfortunately, that's all the time we have for today. I'm David Salkeld, thanking you for being with us, and look forward to having you back here again next week for the weekend edition of Washington Watch with Tony Perkins.
Washington Watch Weekend Edition is powered by the Family Research Council and is entirely listener-supported. For more information on anything you've heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com.